Things that I believe deeply, and I'm going to tell you too much. I hope it makes the same kind of sense to you that it does to me. To begin with, the topic is social reform. And because I always like to stick catchy subtitles after it and pull in the suckers, it says something about visionaries and hostages. I maintain that continuing social reform is essential in every society. The alternative to continuing social reform is dullness, stagnation, and ultimately repression. No free society can long exist unless it continues social reform. Now, the goal of social reform can be merely accommodation to change circumstances. That's important. For example, when we pass anti-pollution laws because the smog has gotten too thick, can you hear back there over the traffic sign? That's social reform, and it's just an accommodation to change circumstances. But there's a far more important goal of social reform that I'll just call social progress. Plonking phrase. But social progress includes a purposeful and deliberate alteration of the circumstances. We don't just adjust to change circumstances, but we make the circumstances change, and then we adjust to them. What do I mean by social progress? That's going to be a key phrase for everything that I say. I want you to know what I mean by it. By social progress, I mean the reforming, the forming again, of social and cultural structures and institutions so that they embody wider sympathies. Wider sympathies. So social progress then is social reform. So not all social reform brings about social progress. I'll come back to that. But we go back to that definition. Social progress is the reforming of social and cultural structures to make them embody wider sympathy. Now, social and cultural structures, and I'm using sociologist language sort of like, so I'm not using it very well. It includes all kinds of things like forms of business organization, corporations, social structures, educational practices, political procedures, techniques of international diplomacy, the values that are firmly held and acted upon by the population and society. These are all included in social structures and institutions. If you think about it carefully, structures like these, all of the ones I mentioned, always embody ideals. They always do. And these ideals are always limited
For example, try to make it vivid. Let's take the educational practices of Horace Grizzlefoot Public School, located in Belgrade, Washington. I hope there is no such town. Is there? All right. We're in Belgrade, Washington, and we're in the Horace Grizzlefoot School District, where the Horace Grizzlefoot kids go to school. Now, the educational practices, what goes on there in those schools, these practices are empowered by ideals, the ideals of the people in that Belgrade School District. Let me just mention some of the ideals without which that institution wouldn't exist the way it does. Children should be educated. The children in the Horace Grizzlefoot District should be well educated. Good education means learning to read, write, finger paint, march in step. You need all kinds of things. I'll just mention the fourth ideal. The children of the Horace Grizzlefoot District should be protected from contaminating contact with less moral, less clean children outside of Belgrade or outside of the Horace Grizzlefoot District. Now, I threw that in very deliberately because that last one points up the way the others didn't, and it's quite as vivid, although they illustrate the same thing, that ideals which get realized in social structures are always limited and limiting. Always. The only question is how limited are they going to be? These ideals always embody limited sympathies. It's important to remember, always important for us to remember, maybe especially important for the kind of people who come to Holden Village, that even our noblest ideals, when they get incarnate in reality, in social structures, so that they are put to work, they are always exclusive and limited. Now, I talked about sympathy, wider sympathy. Sympathy is literally feeling along with. Sympathy is sharing the perceptions of others. Concretely, sympathy is having as your own joys and sufferings the joys and sufferings of someone else. Having it as your own. Having it as your own. Not feeling that you ought to have it as your own. For example, my little 3-year-old Michelle falls down and hurts herself. And I don't have to say, I ought to feel her suffering. I do. And for that, I'm grateful. That reflects a social structure, the family. The evolution of the family in human history is social progress because it embodies wider sympathy. Likewise, the tribe was progress beyond the family, and the nation was progress beyond that, and someday the United Nations, someday, not now, obviously not now. The joys and the sufferings of people outside of the United States are, for the overwhelming majority of us, not felt at all, much less vividly felt, much less made our own. But someday. And after that day when the United Nations becomes a real social institution, then social progress will actualize the entertainment of even more vivid sympathy, because there are degrees of sharing joys and sufferings of others. And after that, there are all sorts of non-human achievements with which we can come to empathize. So we're not going to soon run out of room for progress. But I hope in all of this I've explained to you what I mean by social progress. Does it make sense? The reforming of our social structures so that they embody wider sympathy. So that as a result of the very institutions in which we live, we are not cut off from anything, finally. But that we grow continually to feel the whole universe, share in the joys and sufferings of everyone. Well, now, in talking like this, I'm deliberately not being problem-oriented. I don't know what you expected when you said, you're going to talk about social reform, maybe you thought, Since I was an economist, I started off with how we're going to reform the Federal Reserve System. I'm deliberately steering away from problems, so I really hope that you will get into problems and see if this makes any sense, if this gives us any direction for dealing with some of our problems. But I'm not talking about social reform to overcome problems, because I think we're in real danger of getting hung up on problems. Not that they aren't real enough and urgent enough, but has it ever occurred to you that attacking a problem isn't necessarily the only way of resolving it? You know, problems can sometimes be undercut. Problems can sometimes be melted away. Moreover, the goal of life is not the solution of problems. So we often act as if it were, don't we? All of us. I'm not thinking just of social activists. But we go through life as if the only joy in it is the overcoming of problems. So we thank God each day for the problems he has dumped upon us, without which life would have no meaning. I wonder sometimes how many of us would collapse into paralysis if our problems suddenly disappeared. I'm not talking about social reform in order to overcome problems. This is something much more fundamental. Social progress now, which is essential for the health of a civilization, without the kind of adventure in a civilization that constitutes social progress, a civilization decays. Social progress now requires engineers and visionaries. It doesn't require everyone to be an engineer and a visionary, but it requires them. And it requires the people who respect engineers and visionaries. And social progress is impeded by ostriches. And I want to talk about ostriches. Let me begin by going back to something I said earlier. Not all social reform is social progress. Social reform can occur through force. But social progress always occurs through persuasion. Sympathy is persuasive. You do not have sympathy with anyone because you are forced. You entertain sympathy because of the inherent persuasiveness of the value, the being, with whom you become one. The attempt to realize in practice, embody in our institution, an ideal whose time has not yet come, requires force. And it always results in partial failure, because to the extent that an ideal is imposed by force, it's a new tyranny in a way. It's imposed, so it's a tyranny. It's not the realization of a larger and more inclusive synthesis. I'm talking about something very familiar to all of you when you tell little Johnny, you... Don't you feel that way when your sister falls down, hurts herself? He laughs and you say, "Don't you do that, I'll slug you." You're imposing a tyranny upon you. Now, maybe a necessary tyranny. And maybe out of it something will emerge, but it is a tyranny. You are not thereby helping Johnny to share the joys and sufferings of your sister. That will only be done through persuasion. But at the same time, I want to stress this, so I'm not misunderstood here. An ideal which is effectively imposed by force may come to be appreciated through familiarity. And after that, it may reign among us through its inherent persuasiveness. Now, let me use an example. I will understand. I hope some of the rest of you do. The abolition of slavery in the South constituted tyranny over white Southerners. It's obvious. The war proved it. The events after the war proved it. The reactions of the Southerners to the damn Yankees proved it. But it was a temporary tyranny. I think I'm safe in asserting that the ideal embodied in the 13th Amendment today rules, even in most of Mississippi, by reason of its inherent persuasiveness. You see, it may be necessary to impose an ideal, no slavery. It may be necessary to make that the settled policy of the nation through force, as the lesser of two evils, and then hope, as in this case, that it comes to reign among us by virtue of its sheer persuasiveness. But it is an evil. The recourse to force, however necessary, is evidence of failure. The recourse to force in the Civil War was evidence of our failure to grasp vividly the values of other men. The failure to persuade men, that's the evil, who can be persuaded, who have this capacity to be persuaded by the vivid disclosure of alternatives, the better and the worse. Now, the two great enemies of social progress in our society today are the twin but opposite fruits of a single poisonous plant that I call by a variety of names. I call it privatism sometimes, or I call it radical subjectivism, or I like the phrase absolute relativism. And these are in practice all synonymous, and they are ostrich doctrines. I mean by this doctrine, absolute relativism, the belief, which is widely encouraged among us, that values and the sympathies of men are nothing but personal preferences. That they are the arbitrary selections of human wills which are completely conditioned and might just as well have been other than they are. I have my values, you have yours, and there's the end of the matter. Or we can fight it, we have to. If our values dictate conflicting courses of behavior, we can fight. But we cannot persuade one another because, by definition, values are completely private. They are relative to nothing but the preferences of myself. Yours are relative to nothing but your preferences. From this plant, which is, I say, widely encouraged among us, it is taught as dogma in the social science. From this plant grows two strange fruits, apathy and dogmatism, which are ostrich pests. And they prove their blood relationship by the astonishing ease with which one can be transformed into the other. Apathy says, well, that's your opinion. There's nothing I can do to change it. Goodbye. I'm off to play golf. Dogmatism says, well, that's your opinion. There's nothing I can do to change it. But it's standing in the way of mine, and I have more guns. Or I can make you suffer for it. You see how closely they're related. They both stem from, well, that's your opinion. That's you, you know, and there's nothing I can do to change it. Apathy often turns suddenly into dogmatism when the balance of power seems to shift. How many apathetic people become dogmatists when they get the power. And dogmatism too often turns into cynical apathy when force fails. Have you ever known of vigorous crusading idealists who seemed ready to give up anything for the cause, who failed and collapsed into cynicism? Have you ever met a cynical idealist? It is not true, as I used to argue, as I was arguing briefly a year ago, I'm not convinced I'm completely wrong, that there's a great gulf between the totally apolitical hippies. You know, who say, oh man, politics, man, that's not my thing. I mean, let everybody do his own thing, man. And the militantly political new lefties, who say, we don't like it, tear it down. We don't like it, tear it down. I used to think it was a great gulf between the two. They're opposite sides of the same coin, like Jerry's metaphor. But it is a coin that we have missed, not the you. We who are over 30, we have taught them. We have taught them the doctrine of privatism. For my generation is uniquely the ostrich generation. Now, there are reasons in the history of philosophy that I'm not going to go into for this doctrine of absolute relativism, but that's not important. Philosophers' ideas don't usually catch on among the people. That idea has caught on, the idea that every man's values are completely relative to his preferences, nothing else, has caught on because it has been found comfortable by us. We have found that a very comfortable doctrine. That doctrine has enabled white, affluent Americans to live without adventure, to become old in Borkman's sense. There was at the bottom of the Hiroshima letters. The gospel keeps the world young as long as God allows it to live. But the doctrine of privatism has allowed us to grow old. It's enabled us to live with a quiet conscience amid social realities that are an affront to our ideals, to the ideals that have developed among us and are vividly entertained, that are felt by us, and that are now awaiting realization among us, but whose realization would cause us discomfort. I think it's totally beside the point for us to do, as I've been guilty of doing too, to yell at idealistic youth, there's more freedom, there's more humanitarianism, there's more of everything you want in this country than anywhere else in the world. What are you griping about? I believe that is true. There is more freedom in this country. There is more humanitarianism in this country, I think, than anywhere else in the world. I don't say that. I may be wrong. I'm not bragging. That is a gift which I have received, if it's true, which you have received. But I believe it. But the point is that there is also in this country far more scope for the exemplification of ideals than anywhere else in the world. We cannot judge ourselves by average standards, or we will perish as a civilization. We have enjoyed in this country an unprecedented and astonishing success in freeing ourselves from the bondage of physical necessity. And that is the kind of bondage most men have known throughout most of history and still know today. The literary men have done us a bad service. They have pretended that freedom was primarily a political thing. For most men, freedom is a matter of food on the table. The slavery that they know is hunger. And we are freed from that in just a totally unprecedented way. We have now become free to entertain ideal possibilities that were far beyond the reach of men in previous eras and are still far beyond the reach of most societies in our own era. Privatism, I think, is the sand in which we have hid our heads so that we could be excused from the challenge of adventuring toward the realization in social structures of ideals that are now poised among us, poised vividly in many of our youth and waiting for exemplification in the world. Now, you know, if you want to stop being an optimist, you should not have to become an engineer or a visionary. We couldn't use that many engineers or visionaries, and that's a gift that not all men have. It requires training, not all men are capable of. Stop being an ostrich. All you have to do is stop insisting that your values are private. Admit in your conversations with others what you already know and what you act upon when you're not hypnotized by the doctrine of privatism, that your values, your ideals, are sympathetic perceptions of a real world, of real people who are really experiencing joy and suffering. But the values of all the people with whom you come into contact are also the real sympathetic perception of the joys experienced and suffering tasted by real people. But these are limited perceptions, reflecting limited sympathy, and they are embodied in limiting social structures and institutions, like some of the social structures we thought about after suffering abuse, like the social structure of war as an instrument of diplomacy. It is. War is not going to be abolished suddenly, because war is useful. And I'm not uttering some kind of cynical doctrine, war is useful in getting rid of the surplus population. War is, at the present time, and has been for many centuries, the only means available to nations for resolving disputes. And disputes have to be resolved. It is the final weapon that hangs back of diplomacy in order to make diplomacy serious. It's a necessary institution given the possibilities which are now before us, but it is obviously a limited institution. A 7-year-old child in the poem reminded us what a limiting institution it is. Or the West Coast agricultural system, which steals the life from the migrant worker while it enables him to live. You have to see both of them. It's called the torn down and burned down shack. And for a moment you say, oh goodness, the system's been abolished. And now he has no way to live. That system is the way in which our social structures enable these people to live. And that's why those structures have existed. But they are obviously limited structures. Well, we need engineers and we need visionaries. And I don't want you to strain my choice of terms. I really don't like social engineering. I maybe could have said architects. What I mean is by engineers, well, let me tell you why we need engineers and you can choose your own term. We need something that I'm calling engineers because social structures have their inner logic and they will not sustain just any and every burden that we choose to place upon them. Not every social institution is capable of embodying our ideals. We can take our ideals and pour them into a poorly thought through, rickety, inconsistent, and incoherent social structure and we accomplish nothing. Noble ideals without intelligence can wreak havoc in the world. To the new anti-intellectuals who are growing up among us, I plead the necessity of discipline and rigorous analysis to be applied to all proposals for social reform. But to the new conservatives who are growing up among us, I plead the necessity of visionaries. People who are urging ideals which cannot now be realized. To keep alive among us the vivid ideals by which a civilization is energized. To keep those ideals alive during those long and seemingly arid period when the communal customs in which we share just aren't strong enough to sustain the burden of their exemplification. When our ideals, well, some of the ideals that a person like Bob reflects when he talks and here in the evening, some of those ideals which we cannot find any way to realize in structures right now, those ideals need to be kept alive among us because our structures will be reformed. They will be reformed under the energy of the ideals, and the day will come when our civilization is capable of actualizing those ideals. I'm going to say one thing, very practical. Maybe this is bad practice. I'm going to quit. I want to say thank you to Will, and through him to all of the black men from Stokely Carmichael on, because his declaration was the one that first hit all the white liberals in the face. men who began talking about black power and thereby offended all their friends. Many friends in the Negro community. I choose the word Negro to listen to. Many, many white liberals who had felt very close to these people, men like Joseph Brian Michael, and who suddenly felt betrayed. Do you know how difficult it is to betray a friend, to seem to betray a friend? To go on down a difficult road with somebody and now find that you must take a direction that he can't understand, which he is compelled to condemn. He says, I must, in defense of the values and all that I hold dear. Now the white liberal was speaking. After all the white liberals were told to get out of SNCC and go back to their white communities and do something there, they said, in the name of the values which I believe, integration, the brotherhood of man, powerful humanitarian ideal, I must condemn you. Can you imagine how difficult it was for these new black men to seem to betray their friends? But anyone who has been beat over the head long enough by what they were saying so that finally it got through has to be grateful to these men, because they believed firmly enough that their perceptions were not just subjective preferences, not just statements of, well, I'm going to be black. They believed that they had a sympathetic perception of a real world and wider sympathies which they wanted us to share. And they did not retreat into the little company of men who felt as they did and saw as they did, that they came out, maybe came up to Holden Village and tried to enable us to share their perception. I've been asked, I've asked myself, is this the gospel? No, it's not the gospel. When I say that we as civilizations must adventure toward the creation, the structure, the body, wider sympathies, I assert with a great deal of confidence that this is God's work to do, but it isn't the gospel. God is calling us toward adventure, which we haven't even realized existed. But that's not the gospel. Willie was not giving us the gospel a week or so ago when he was telling us how blinded we were, that we just couldn't see certain things that were right there in front of our eyes. It was when Willie said, what's the matter? Are you all feeling guilty? I forgive you. That's the best. And I wonder how many of us are ostriches. Well, we're all ostriches because we're afraid. I know ostriches don't really hide their head in the sand, but have a little poetic life. We are ostriches because we're afraid. That's why men are ostriches. Men love the comfortable because they're afraid. And the gospel says, fear not. I have gone before you.
But I think it's a tough call for a lot of the people to carry more tax. It's a huge carry. But a lot of that can be heard with that.
Think, Carol, they're afraid of dialogue. See, if you enter into dialogue with someone who is saying something, who is pointing to something you haven't seen, and you know that should you see it, you know, of course, it isn't there, but should you see it, you would never be the same again. You know, don't tell me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know.
You can change that particular style, but if you like this one man who's quantified as being a critic, he's interrupted right now, he's critical about me, Mike. I have a brother-in-law who has a state hospital in that state account, and he thinks he's got a common task, which means he has to lose his town property. And then he walked out of me in 2 days last year, and he didn't even enter the argument. Never entered a single review for the deal. He never talked to him, never talked to me. He was gone back and squashed his place in the community area. Is that it?
I don't know, Carol. I don't know. But he's got to be afraid. There is no reason for refusing to engage another man in dialogue. There's no reason for refusing to take seriously the fact that he asserts, I have seen a vision, except that you're afraid of that vision. Or you're bored by the effort.
What about what you said about our problem-solving orientation? Sometimes I think that's true, that all of us sort of live that way day by day, looking for new problems to solve. And we see in discussions, not just here, but any that we have, an immediate effort to find a solution to this problem. We do this all the time. And sometimes when you engage in dialogue, and you're forced into seeing something, you see the enormity of it. And you begin then to see it isn't a matter of a simple problem solving thing. When Willie talks about white racism, you know, why do so many people fight that? They won't fight anything else, but they'll really just fight that idea of the pervasiveness of white racism, not just totally involved with the person, and we are all white racists. And finally, it seems to me that one of the things is it makes that problem a tremendously enormous one. You can't go running out tomorrow. Because you're talking about changing something so large that the immediate thing is almost a paralysis. You know, it's simpler to look at race and say, well, it's a matter of this guy being nasty down here, you know, in these little ways. But the enormity of it is just is overwhelming, and it erases all the simple kinds of solutions you might think of. Then you get down to radical change, and in fact, and revolution, really, which is very frightening.
By the way, revolution is a form of social reform. So that I'm not accused of being a reformist. I'm not sure what the difference is between revolution and reform. Sometimes I try to define the term. Reforming social institutions. That can be done in a variety of ways. I guess I'm by trade or conversion or something, I'm a strong believer in words. I like words. But words are the most distinctively human thing we have. It is through words. Now, there's nonverbal communication, but I'm a little afraid that we're in danger of forgetting that nonverbal communication rests upon a foundation, a substratum of prior verbal communication. Someone whom you haven't talked to, you know, I've never spoken to them still, although that's very rare. You've never spoken to a person, it's very rare that you'll be able to have really meaningful nonverbal communication with them. But even if you haven't spoken to that person, you live in a community which has shared words and thereby has shared perception and sympathy. And that's the way that we enter into one another's joy and suffering. So sympathy includes much more than the joy and suffering. There's a danger of words, especially when our words grow tired, when our words cease to convey to other people the vision floating before our eyes. And that quickly happens. We do get tired, and our attention span is limited, and we get impatient and want to go on to something else. And we shouldn't be sitting around talking all the time. I'm not calling for long sessions as we all rapidly start, without any knowledge of what the problem is. I'm protesting against something. It is the refusal to admit. I'll make it very simple. I don't want anybody to go out of here tonight without knowing what it is I'm primarily attacking. It is this thing that you hear all the time. And say, a guy will say something very strong. Well, I believe that the Vietnam War is wrong. But of course, that's just my opinion. Now, what does that mean? That's an ostrich talking. Of course, that's his opinion. Yeah, he said it. That's his opinion. I know that. When he says that's just my opinion, what does he mean? Does he mean that is not a judgment about what is happening to people? It is a judgment about the real world growing out of a real perception. Limited. Needing amplification. Correction, needing the contribution of the person who sits across from him and says, well, in my opinion, you're wrong, but of course that's mine. It's as if the most important thing, the matters about which civilization is fundamentally concerned, don't exist. It's as if concern, in the Quaker sense of the word concern, or the pastor who say, I lay this concern upon your heart. It's as if concern is nothing but an indignant belch expressing some gaseous morality. That isn't so.
All right.
no, Belk is very sincere. No, wait a minute, no, Belk is... And when I say that is wrong, that must be changed, I'm not just telling you there are atoms, molecules bumping around inside of me that have motivated me to right now utter the word, that is wrong. I'm saying that is wrong. That is wrong. That out there. And what I'm protesting against is the fact that we are being indoctrinated not to think that way. We are being indoctrinated to believe that people sympathies and concerns and empathies and are nothing but subjective preferences. Like, I like spinach. You don't. When the sympathies are vividly entertained, I struggle for means to some way to embody these concerns. And the social structure, like the family, provides opportunity. The family does embody these concerns. It expresses the ideals of a wider range of caring and gives opportunity for actual caring, not just hurting with her, but actually ministering through the hurt. See, and now, so there's two things that have to go forward simultaneously, and they feed upon one another. The vivid entertainment of ideals, wider ideals, are necessary to call forth social structures that are necessary if we're able to do anything about the ideals. I mean, like tonight, we watched the slides, the migrant workers, and we entertain vivid bonds of sympathy and concern. But our accumulated communal customs just are not adequate right now to enable us to do about that problem what we want to do.
In the state of Washington, some of these things that we do through the health department, we're given 5 years to upgrade their houses and afterwards. So whether we feel strongly enough about them or not, in order to be on the right side of law, we're required to be.
Yeah, which may be an example of it's funny how many pieces of legislation that are regarded as tyranny, you have no right to make me do that. It establishes, make us familiar with ideals. We begin living out the ideals grumblingly. They get embodied.
Because you get a better grade of paper, they're better to, they're more willing to take in longer hours, they're happier, get some doctor.
Yeah, well, that is the growth of communal customs then, which make more things possible, but that sort of thing never energizes progress. That's the lust after comfort. And a civilization which goes lusting after mere comfort is doomed to decay. It will stagnate. And stagnation is going to mean repression. It's going to mean that we will have to spit on one another to keep order.
Sorry, did you hear?
He said the guy in the tennis movie could legally sleep. Yeah, he could legally sleep. But fortunately, he couldn't read.
Then it helps some with the
We all need to have optimism, I know what we got. I mean, we all have to have ideas before us and things to work for. But I'm frankly real curious and like to have you comment a little bit. Where do you think a certain amount of optimism I thought into, like the world is getting better and better, the world is more than the extent that something will do, and try to make you much more work than something that will, you know.
It is not inevitable. It is not inevitable. Say that for sure. It is a possibility. And as we look back, say over the last 2,000 years, we can see how ideals that at one time were condemned as totally beyond possibility. Maybe philosophers would say, yes, well, it would be nice if that was possible, but given the nature of man, the nature of social customs and all that, that's impossible. Slavery is an excellent example. How did it come about that it became the settled policy of the Western nations to eliminate slavery? Came about through those forces which vividly impressed upon our sensitivities a wider range of sympathy, through making real and incontrovertible to us such doctrines as the brotherhood of man, the dignity of man. These have not always been doctrines firmly held by the universe. Men do not today practice among one another, thank God, the kinds of unsympathetic cruelties which they did only a few hundred years ago. This is evidence of social progress. But that is not inevitable. It is always possible to lapse back into barbarism, not being German. An incredibly rapid lapse back into barbarism. A huge leap. So I'm not, there is a note of optimism in what I say, but I hope, I'm not.
Ideal of a better world. If we need a better world, we need people with better hearts. And to me, again, it's a skill of the human. I can only see the better heart in about to replace something in the heart. Outside of that, we're living outside paradise, and never going to achieve a better heart without Christ in the heart.
We aren't going to achieve a paradise on this earth with Christ. The ultimate perfection is something which lies beyond history. And it's that civilization has had it, which thinks it's attained that ultimate perfection. As our society, I think, has been in danger of supposing. And it's been visited by deep division, polarization. You would think back 10 years ago, the smugness and the complacency with which most of us thought about the accomplishments of America, all our problems. And we were raising up the colors, and we were sending aid to the nations of the world, and here at home we were marching triumphantly into the decade of the 60s, which turned to ashes in our mouth. Now, I quite agree. I don't put it that way, but right, a change in the hearts of men. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the entertainment of wider thinking. That's how I define that kind of change in heart. That's how I define love. You know, I think we ought to think more about love. We ought to love more, too, but we ought to think about it occasionally. And ask ourselves, what do you mean by love? And you say, love is the solution to the world's problems. And we ought to realize, too, that love, when actualized, is always a limiting thing. That love is not a free good. The love that I bestow upon one is not there for another. And our social institutions and structures make love much more limited when it's actualized than it would need to be. We could have social institutions such that an act of love was bestowed upon one person was less limited than it now is. But what love means, I think, is this vivid sympathy with another being, such that when it's there, you don't need to be told to do anything. And that is not something that comes by the preaching of the law. And as a Christian, I look back and I see my own continual, over and over again, emancipation from limited sympathy as having occurred through the encounter with Jesus Christ and the people who are talking about him and doing his act. And I think it's very important that we Christians put it in that way, that we not say to the non-Christians, whether they call themselves that and aren't, or do call themselves that and are, let's not say to people calling themselves non-Christians, Jesus Christ is the only answer, as kind of a flaw. Say, you can't be a part of him. Jesus Christ opened me up. I'm not suggesting we can't use Jesus Christ as a club with which to exclude other people.
Well, I think one thing we can never stop trying to be for, and that is that fair play is something that is in no way, exclusive to the Christian. I think the same Christian can't begin in the moment. One of the tremendous things that we should not completely unneeded to have was the sense of justice. So, we can stop, fortunately, for the world of the human model. This is what we are. I mean, that sense of fair play of giving another guy room to live is something that can be come up even out of tedium with the pain. And as far as some of these issues are concerned, that's my hope. Nobody likes to just have so much of the pain all the time. And the very fact the world's getting closer and TV coverage is going to be artists from South Africa and the emerging nations and what that means in China and so on. And within a few years, we'll have these satellite stations. And you can't help but be living in an immense encounter with variety. But I think there's going to be something for us, apart from the fact that conversion comes off this road to all of us. You know.
But it can scare us. Yeah. And another thing, a funny thing you can do, you remember the Carol in the 1930s, all of the anthropologists were being cultural relativists. They were running out writing books showing that nobody else did it the way we did it, and it worked over there. And I think they contributed a lot to the ostrich mentality now. Because there are two ways to see variety. One is to see it, as gee whiz, look at all the ways in which it can be done. Another is to say, gee, look at all the ways people act. Who's to say what's better?